Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferens.
Infrastructure and manufacturing, how the White House is preparing America for the future. The occupations to avoid if you want to live. And today on the show, the Minnesota Federation of Teachers and why we need to be concerned about elections in America. Welcome to the Friday, April 29th edition of America's Workforce, where we are available on at least six platforms. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Pandora, and Stitcher. We have two guests on the show today. We're going to start things off with Greta Callahan. Greta is president of the Minneapolis Federation of Teachers. That would be Local 59. She taught kindergarten in Minneapolis for the last decade. Actually, she was a finalist for Minnesota Teacher of the Year going back to 2017. She's a graduate of the Midwest Labor Leadership Initiative and is also executive VP of the Minneapolis Regional Labor Federation, and also serves on the Executive Committee of Education Minnesota. We'll talk about that. She started her career in a charter school, which is why she has dedicated her life to fighting for strong public schools. And she's going to talk about the conditions in the charter school that she worked in. And we're seeing a lot of organizing in charter schools all around America because of the working conditions. We're going to address that. But more importantly, we're going to talk about one heck of a win. On March 8th, thousands of teachers and education support professionals who make up the Minneapolis Federation of Teachers walked off the job. This was the first time they did so since 1970. And it happened after contract talks with the Minneapolis Public Schools failed. And we're talking bread and butter issues. We're talking wages, class size. That was pretty much the heart of the dispute. And there was also some debates over how best to recruit and retain teachers of color in Minneapolis. Well, that strike lasted for 3 weeks, and you may recall me talking about it on the show. Because when teachers go on strike, they do so for very good reason. This one was garnering national attention because of the solidarity, not only of the labor community, but the parents and the students. The students were upset that the teachers weren't getting a fair deal. And we'll talk about that. This dispute put the Minneapolis Federation of Teachers squarely in line with their counterparts in many other cities and states. In this year alone, teachers in districts that stretch from Sacramento to the Chicago area have gone on strike protesting ongoing contract stalemates and onerous working conditions. You heard about the Red for Ed movement that started in many right-to-work states. Well, it's still bubbling out there. And Greta's going to talk about that. She'll give us a national perspective on what happened in one community and how that is happening or may happening all around America, because public education is so important. And frankly, the right wing is attacking public schools. Over 90% of the people in America, students in America, go to public schools. And they're attacking. They're attacking the schools. We know they're attacking the curriculum. And they're attacking the teachers because in public schools, most likely they are in a union. And that's what this is all about. So Greta is going to be our first guest. Steve Rosenfeld will be joining us later in the show. He's been on several times, and he's a really interesting guy. He is editor and chief correspondent of Voting Booth, which is a project of the Independent Media Institute. And he's been on a number of radio and TV stations, progressive publications. And what he's been doing, he monitors what's going on with elections in America. And right now, this is scary. Right now, more than 80 election-denying candidates are running for either governor, attorney general, or secretary of state in the primaries. And many of these primaries are happening in the next week. Secretary of State, keep in mind, monitors elections in every state. You've seen what happened with the attacks on the Secretary of State in Georgia. According to one election security specialist, David Maida, he said that 2021 was far worse than 2020. The temperature from 2020 had carried over and gotten worse and just keeps escalating because of all the mistrust from this misinformation and questions about the security and fairness of our voting systems. This is all from what happened with Trump and his big lie. Said that Biden was not the winner, that he won. And if you keep saying that, people are going to believe it. And he's got an army of people that are saying it as well. And they're running on that. They're running on that. Like I said, really scary stuff. And Steve Rosenfeld, on behalf of the Voting Booth Project, is going to put it all together as our second guest right after Greta Callahan today. Well, Marty Walsh, our Secretary of Labor, is in Ohio today. He's visiting Lorain County Community College to highlight how the proposed Bipartisan Innovation Act will advance U.S. global leadership in the technologies of the future and also build on the bipartisan infrastructure law. Now, that Innovation Act, we talked about this on the show many, many times, especially yesterday with Government Affairs Director Bill Samuel of the AFL-CIO. And that was a really good analysis. If you missed it, just go to our podcast or go to the website, awfradio.com. The secretary joined a roundtable, including representatives from the college and from the Boeing company, along with Nexflex, which is a consortium of American electronics companies, academic institutions, nonprofits, along with state, local, and federal government partners. Now, this consortium is seeking to advance U.S. manufacturing of printed flexible electronics. That's interesting. Printed flexible electronics. The discussion was on how the Innovation Act, the Bipartisan Innovation Act, will aid in the creation of a skilled talent pipeline to strengthen U.S. manufacturing, promoting STEM education and equity, and accelerating regional economic growth. And during the event, participants also unveiled new funding for workforce development in Ohio, as well as other parts of the nation. The community colleges are really on top of this. You've heard of these advanced manufacturing programs, and they've been doing this for years. And I can understand why Marty came to Northeastern Ohio today, because the Intel plant is just a couple hours away that they're going to build in Central Ohio. So all good things happening. And once again, we got a great guy as Labor Secretary. You know, yesterday we were talking about Workers' Memorial Day, and one thing I did not have at my disposal was the selected occupations with high fatality rates. And these are figures from 2 years ago, 2020. So these are occupations you probably want to avoid. And when I was thinking about this, well, gee, which is the most dangerous occupation? And I would think like coal mining, maybe some of the trades. The most dangerous? Fishing and hunting. That's right. Fishing and hunting. The national fatality rate per 100,000 workers is 3.4. So 3.4 workers out of 100,000 die every year in a certain industry. I mean, that's when you put them all together. It's 132 per 100,000 in fishing and hunting. Okay. National average, 3.4 fishing and hunting, 132. That's followed by logging at 92, roofers 47, big drop there. Let's see, the trades are at 43.3, followed by aircraft pilots and flight engineers, 34. Let's see, those in the refuse and recyclable industry, 33. Structural iron and steel workers, 32.5. 32.5 per 100,000. And that's followed by truck drivers, then mining at 21.6, and then farmers, ranchers, and agriculture workers at 20.9, just shy of 21 deaths per 100,000. Also this week, National Kosh, and we've cited them many times before. They came out with their Dirty Dozen Unsafe Employers, and one of them is Amazon. Six dead at the Bessemer warehouse. That happened when the tornadoes came through there, and they told the workers, you got to stay working. Don't worry about it. It'll pass. Remember that? There's a utility, Atlantic Coast Utility, outside of Boston. Two workers died. The company lied to get their construction permits there. Dakin America, they're based in Decatur, Alabama. Three died from toxic exposures. How about this one? Ernst Nursery and Farms, out of St. Paul, Oregon. A farm worker died during the heat wave of last year. The company told OSHA the employee should be accountable for how they pushed their body. It's the employee's fault. I remember it was like 115, 120 degrees, and they told them to keep working. And you know how long farm workers are in the field, 12, 13, 14, 15 hours. It's their fault. It's their fault. Another one here, and this was, I remember talking about this one, Gainesville, Georgia. Six workers dead from a nitrogen leak, and the company tried to block the OSHA investigation. They were intimidating the survivors. It's amazing. Just Google National Kosh, and you'll find the Dirty Dozen. Scary stuff, really scary stuff. And one more here. Workers at a Jack in the Box in Sacramento walked off the job this week. Why? In protest of management's failure to protect workers from threats to their safety. After a pregnant worker was threatened at gunpoint during a robbery at that Jack location, the management allegedly refused to allow the worker to go home and cut the worker's hours when she refused to finish her shift. Oh my God. A California-based report from the end of last year highlights that this is not an isolated incident. Violent activity, I'm quoting from the report, violent activity at fast food restaurants all across California generates tens of thousands of 911 calls a year. Violence, which comes at a high cost to workers. Veronica Gonzalez, one of the workers featured in the report, who worked for a different Jack in the Box location, this is in Alameda, recounts a customer threatening to kill her after she asked the customer to put on a mask. In response, Veronica says that her manager told her to be quiet and respectful. Well, there's something wrong in America, huh? All right, we have to take a quick break. When we come back, Greta Callahan talking about that 3-week-long teacher strike in Minneapolis.
This is America's Workforce.
It takes LIUNA to build North America's infrastructure. From roads and bridges to schools and skyscrapers, the men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, build the projects we depend on. From constructing the Freedom Tower on the site of the former World Trade Center to untangling Washington, D.C.'s congested interstate, LIUNA members do the work that matters. Find out what it takes to be built by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
America's workforce is being brought to you in part by the Communication Workers of America.
There is unity and strength for workers.
We are the USW.
We are the USW.
The United Steelworkers.
The largest industrial union in North America.
We represent 850,000 members in the U.S., Canada, and the Caribbean.
We work in metals,
rubber,
chemicals,
paper,
oil refining,
atomic energy, and the service sector.
We are steelworkers, standing strong and fighting for what's right.
America's Workforce appreciates our sponsor, the Columbus Central Ohio Building and Construction Trades Council, who represents more than 18,000 workers from 19 affiliated local unions and district councils.
American workers are the best in the world, but we face an uphill battle against countries like China that don't play by the rules. There's a bill right now in Congress that would give American workers the trade tools we need to fight back and win. Join me in telling Congress to pass this bill. Visit AmericanManufacturing.org to learn how.
Paid for by the Alliance for American Manufacturing.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And don't forget, you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle AWF Union Podcast. AWF Union Podcast. Let's go to Minneapolis, Minnesota right now. Joining us on our live line is Greta Callahan. Talked about Greta a lot on this show in March when her union, Minneapolis Federation of Teachers, went on strike. And I'll tell you, it was a strike that attracted national attention, a lot of issues concerning teachers, not just in that area, but around the country. And we're going to talk about that on the show today. Greta Callahan, welcome back to the show. How are we doing today, my sister?
Oh, wonderful. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, we talked a lot about you. I tried to text you a couple times. Hey, come on the show. Come on the show. And I know you wanted to, but you were on the picket line. You were a busy, busy girl during that whole time, weren't you?
Oh, my. I didn't sleep. Picket line in the morning, negotiating all day, all night. Yeah. So thanks for understanding and thanks for carrying our message in the meantime.
Hey, that's what the show is all about. So I appreciate you coming on today and kind of like dissecting what happened during those 3 weeks. But before we do that, I want to talk about how you got engaged in union activity. First question,
yeah.
Do you come from a union family? Was there any influence there? No? No?
Not at all. I didn't even know what a union was growing up. And I just, once I became a teacher, I just got the first job that would take me, which was at a charter school. And I had no idea what the difference was between charter, public. None of it made sense to me, but I was just so happy to have a classroom. I was there for 2 years. And during that time, we had students who needed more supports. And I watched my principal at the time coach families out of the building after October, which is our funding cutoff date, and say things like, if you take your child out of the school, we won't put it on their permanent record and we won't expel them then. To students with special needs, he would say to their parents, if you take them out, they'll get more support. We don't have the supports for your child at this school. But he would do it in October. And I knew something was wrong, and so did the other staff members. When we had some teachers who were very brave, that was not me at the time, go to the board, who was a hand-picked board at the time, telling them some of the things that were happening, and that's just a snippet. They thanked us, and then they fired the colleagues who spoke up in front of us and escorted them out of the building. It was the most horrifying experience of my life until seeing what happened behind closed doors during the strike. And it was terrifying, and it was a lesson to everyone in the room, like, don't ever speak up again for kids. When I finally moved over to public schools, to the Minneapolis public schools, I had a $20,000 raise overnight. I could speak up for kids. Literally zero times have I ever heard the words, we can't serve your child. That is not something you can say in a public school. And my first or second year teaching, at Minneapolis Public Schools, there was an article released that was called The Worst Teachers Teach in the Poorest Schools. And it specifically named my school and just blamed and shamed teachers for basically poverty. And I wrote a response that was the most read op-ed in our local paper at the time that year. And overnight, we had the superintendent at the school. They were trying to put me on leave. And my union president showed up, and I got to stay. And I realized, because of a union, not only did I have a raise and we could stand up for kids, but we can fight for their education. We can speak truth to power. And nobody can come in and fire us and escort us out of the building because of a union. So because of a union, we can stand up for kids. And I have been like diehard ever since then. And I'm just so proud of what we can accomplish because of a union for our public schools and for our students. We are literally the only thing standing in the way of privatizing all of the schools in Minneapolis and across the country.
Those of you listening right now know why Greta Callahan is president of the Minneapolis Federation of Teachers. I don't know anybody that could tell that story any better than you, Greta. That's awesome. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have to ask you, that charter school that you worked at, your first job, Are they still in operation over there?
No, they closed down after 2 years, like most charter schools.
Okay, okay. That's good to hear. That's good to hear. Amazing. Yeah. Just amazing. Yeah, that. I mean, there's cases of FBI raiding charter schools because they're
absolutely
so corrupt.
So corrupt, and it just funnels money away from our students, and we're watching our classrooms become defunded, and so many stand to profit off of that happening, and that's what we're standing in the way of and not allowing to happen here in Minneapolis. And believe me, the forces are very real and alive in this city to dismantle the Minneapolis public schools.
Oh, sure. It's continuing everywhere. What about organizing? Because we originate this show in Cleveland, Ohio. There's a lot of good organizing happening at charter schools in this area and across the state. Is any of that happening in your area?
Yeah, a little bit. Our state has been able to organize a very small handful of the charter schools in Minnesota. And so that's wonderful. And we can't wait for, you know, everyone to be unionized. And simultaneously, we really need charters to not exist, period. We need to fully fund our schools. We need to focus on all of the gaps that are happening in this world and government's failures and society's inequities so that our students can receive the education that they all deserve.
Greta, let's talk about the strike. The strike began in early March, and I'm sure you tried to avoid going on strike, but kind of go back to that. Nobody wants to go on strike. Let's be honest.
No,
I mean
that's
tough. It's tough on everybody. But what was the final? I guess the last straw. I mean, you were talking and talking and talking, and all of a sudden said, "Hey, we got to go on strike." Can you go back to that time?
Absolutely. So educators across the country know what we have all been going through, like in general, over the last couple of decades, watching our schools become defunded, watching us do so much more with so much less. And then watching, you know, decisions of those at the top when we are in crisis, whether it's a crisis of staffing, whether it's COVID. And in the Minneapolis public schools, we have seen some like horrifying decisions around students' education, their lives, our profession. We had a comprehensive district design happen in the middle of a pandemic where something like 10,000 kids had to change schools. Hundreds, if not over thousands of educators had to change schools. It completely overturned any community we had happening in that and had built, which is so important in order for kids to succeed and learn. And then, of course, during the pandemic, once we were back in school in person, just the staffing issues and the refusal to pay people to take on more kids or having literally nobody was getting a prep because they're covering other classes. And it was just like one thing on top of another. And we happened to be in this contract negotiations that started well over a year ago where we are fighting for safe and stable schools. And we're in Minneapolis. We are definitely not the highest paid when it comes to surrounding districts. In fact, teachers are like 13th or 14th in a list of 19 surrounding districts when it comes to pay. Our ESPs, which are education support professionals, are making poverty wages. We have class sizes that are out of control. Our students absolutely need more mental health support, not fewer. And we also really fought for like some real supports for educators of color, led by educators of color. And those were some of our priorities. And so as all of these things are coming together, people are feeling demoralized, dehumanized by the system, by those at the top of the Minneapolis public schools, including our school board and our superintendent. And when we took our strike authorization vote, we had 98 and 97% of our chapters, because we have a education support professional chapter and a teacher chapter, voting yes to strike. And we have not had a strike since 1952. So this is absolutely no question that we were ready to walk for the schools our students deserve. And that there should have made the district move on these top issues that I just mentioned, and they did not, they would not. Behind closed doors was absolutely terrifying. Zero, and I mean this, zero of those people give two F's about children who were on the other side of that table. And that was the scariest part, I think, of this entire experience. This is about adult egos. This is about power. This is about control. And in a district, you know, that received hundreds of millions of ESSER funds, we have had a very healthy finances and budget in the Minneapolis Public Schools. We have an 8% reserve balance. The money was there, but the political will was not. So we thought absolutely that they would come to some agreements with us to avoid the strike, and they did not even pretend to avoid it. And when we went out, that didn't change. And like I tell people, like, I'm traumatized from the experience of watching from what happened from within, because they would have kept us out forever. There were 3 days in this strike where they refused to even talk to us or pass us a counter proposal. So we were out 3 weeks. We absolutely won in more ways than contract wins. We were able to secure higher wages for our education support professionals. We got class size caps in the contract, which is the second contract in the state to achieve this. We were able to get a social worker in every building and add some counselors and nurses. We were able to secure language and protections around accessing and layoffs for educators of color without losing seniority. And there were, you know, other little things as well that we won, but we should not have had to be out on strike for 3 weeks in order to achieve these things that our students so desperately need, the stability that they need in staffing and their classroom experience. And it was us. It was us together. It was this act of solidarity, because it wasn't just teachers. We went out with our education support professionals. We got out together. We came back in together. And this act of love and solidarity, we could not have achieved any of this without each other. But some of the wins that we got that are not in our contract is, during our strike, some of these really bad players at the top who are extremely anti-union, who have been driving this district off the cliff, started resigning. So we had a school board member resign. We had the head of HR resign. Our superintendent resigned. And there are more in the works right now, is what I'm hearing, in addition to someone who we believe is getting fired. There's a school board race coming up where we have 5 seats open, which would give a majority on that school board, because right now we have an incredibly weak school board and a couple of people on there who work very closely with corporate ed reform groups. So there's so much hope coming out of this strike, like what it did to rejuvenate and wake up this city and to strengthen our public schools, and not to mention other unions around us. We were able to fight alongside our food service workers, our clerical staff, who now might be going out on strike. So it's just been such a beautiful act of solidarity. And without all of these other unions around us, none of this would have been possible or successful.
Oh, my gosh. What a clean sweep. Not only you win a contract, you got rid of the union busters. That's really
exactly. Oh, yes.
Oh, my gosh. Greta, I got to take a break. Greta Callahan joining us on our live line, and she is president of the Minneapolis Federation of Teachers. Here's the website. It's MFT59.org, MFT59. They're also on Facebook, and you can follow them on Twitter as well. Later in the show, Steve Rosenfeld will be checking in with us, talking about the elections. We're going to look at the primaries and how some election-denying candidates may win office. Back in a few minutes.
You're listening to America's Workforce with Ed Flash Ferens.
It takes LIUNA to power North America with affordable energy. The men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, have the skills needed to build and maintain oil, natural gas, nuclear, solar, and wind projects that are shaping America's energy future. From new energy tech to retrofitted facilities, LIUNA members do it all. Find out what it takes to be powered by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
The United Auto Workers are one of the largest and most diverse unions in North America, with members in virtually every sector of the economy. Learn more about this proud sponsor of our program at UAW.org.
The United Steelworkers of America represent over 70,000 workers in the state of Ohio. Steelworker members enjoy the benefits of some of the best contracts of any workers in the world. Many of your friends, neighbors, and relatives are members of one of the most effective democratic unions in our country. With the pressures unorganized workers are under in today's economy, you need to join them. So call the Steelworkers Organizing Office at 216-292-5683 or toll free at 1-800-443-3752.
A great union requires a reliable election system. Survey and Ballot Systems is a trusted election partner with more than 30 years of expertise in managing union elections. By partnering with SBS, your union can ensure it gets an auditable process and a high level of customer service. SBS is here to help you conduct your union vote securely, transparently, and with trust building always in mind. Visit surveyandballotsystems.com to learn more.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And don't forget, we're available on at least six platforms. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Pandora, and Stitcher. And when you get an opportunity, just sign up, receive our shows on a regular basis, and give us a rating. We always appreciate a five-star rating. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the North Coast Labor Federation. A couple things I want to touch on before we rejoin Greta Callahan over in Minneapolis as president of the Minneapolis Federation of Teachers. There's going to be a union-busting May Day march and rally this Sunday. Sunday is International Workers' Day. This is happening in New York, and they're marching and rallying right on Union Square. That should get a lot of attention. And then on Monday, there's going to be an Ohio jobs rally in Lorain, Ohio, and this is all about that submarine project, which was announced a couple of months ago, and we've talked about this on the show. In fact, Jimmy Hart, who heads the Metal Trades Department of the AFL-CIO, is going to be there along with Tim Berga, Mike Nisey of the Ohio State Building Trades, as well as the retired Navy captain, Ed Bartlett, who's trying to put this together. And I talked to him last week, and he said, we thought it was a done deal, but then again, you're dealing with the government. So I think enough is said right there. But hopefully, there'll be enough people at that rally. That's going to be from 10 to 11 a.m. Monday, May 2nd at Black River Landing in Lorain, Ohio. All right, let's go back to our live line and rejoin Greta Callahan talking about the three-week-long Minneapolis teacher strike. Okay, Greta, I have to ask you, you had all these people. They knew that there was solidarity. You said 97-98% of the teachers voted to authorize a strike. I mean, right, that when they, and they knew that, they should have figured something had to be done right away. They didn't do it, but when was the breaking point? When did they come to you, or what was it that turned this around? That's my question. What's your take on that?
Well, we really had to take care of our members, take care of our students. We were out for 3 weeks. There absolutely was a point where we knew we extracted all we could extract from the district. We, as the teacher chapter, did secure the highest raise we've received in 22 years. Our ESPs had gotten significantly higher wages. We did secure some of these other things in contract language or MOAs that we wanted. And simultaneously, we know that we deserve so much more, and what we had secured and had extracted, we knew we should never have had to withhold our work to do so. But what we did know was that the district leaders, and as they were crumbling from within, changing negotiators and all that stuff, we knew that they would have continued to keep our children and our staff out. And we knew that we weren't going to get more from them. Mm-hmm. And quite frankly, we had to get out together. So ESPs and teachers, it was imperative that we didn't leave anybody behind in this process. And so we had to make some really tough decisions, and we had to make those decisions based out of love and based out of solidarity for each other, but for our students. We knew that our district leaders were not going to put them first. They were not going to even consider them. They're an afterthought. Their education means nothing to these people. And so we did what was best for the whole. And that was getting out when we did. The following week, people were going to lose their health insurance because it would have been a new month. There was a lot of things going on that helped us get to this decision. And at the end of the day, we knew we did extract all we could from them in this moment.
Yeah, the health insurance is a real big one. You talked about the educational support personnel, ESPs. What were they making before the strike?
Oh, on average, $24,000 a year. And now they will be closer to $35,000 a year.
$24,000 a year. Jeez, amazing. Just amazing.
Yeah,
you can't make ends meet doing
that. No, you cannot. And even with $35K, you can't. But our students don't know who's in front of them anymore when you are paying people poverty wages. And quite frankly, when you're not paying the licensed professionals what other districts are paying around you as well. And when we say we're fighting for safe and stable schools, our kids can't have stability if they don't know the people in front of them because they're turning over so frequently, or we can't keep them.
Yeah. How are you doing with that? Because I know a lot of teachers in various states are leaving the profession because, well, the COVID situation didn't help. But are you dealing with that in that area? And maybe you can even speak for all of Minnesota.
Yeah, big time. I can speak for Minneapolis. We are hemorrhaging great educators from this profession, educators, period. During our strike, there was, especially from outside corporate ed reform groups who, weaponized race, were really like trying to go after seniority. And saying like, oh, we can't lose educators of color from layoffs. And we did the math, and we have lost 45 educators of color in 15 years from layoffs. But 120 educators of color have left our district in the last year and a half. This is a crisis.
Yeah.
And when we talk to our members, this is about support. This is about pay. This is about respect. This is about having joy in your work. And when you have joy in your work, your students have joy in school, and we all have to have that and deserve it. And so like this fight is so much more than just contract language. This is about our profession. This is like for the soul of our city, the soul of education. And we continue to lose people. And quite frankly, during this strike, people on the inside on our team were, witnessing firsthand how district leaders were behaving. And they're like, I will not continue working in this district for these people anymore. Like our own people on the bargaining team were thinking and saying these things. And so we keep losing great people. But our only hope to change that is us, is a strong union, is a strong contract, and is the support of our students and families around us, which we have more than ever right now.
That's awesome. Well, you want to keep the good people and you want to get rid of the bad people. And you got rid of the bad people. There's no doubt about that. Those of you listening
right now. Yes, we fired our bosses.
Yeah, Greta mentioned in the first segment that the superintendent resigned along with the HR director and a school board member. And this all happened during and immediately following the strike. So what a game changer. Greta, thank you so much for joining us. I really wanted to get into your head on what happened here, because like I told you earlier, I followed this and I've had you on the show before. I know what kind of union leader you are. And my hat's off to you and all the teachers in that area and all the teachers in America. We got a national audience. This is a tough job, really tough job. So hang in there and stay with your union. Union strong. That's what it's all about, isn't it, Greta?
Forever, yes. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate all you do.
All right. MFT59.org. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Steve Rosenfeld will be joining us talking about the election-denying candidates. That's coming up next.
This is America's Workforce. More shows available at awfradio.com.
It takes LIUNA to keep America running. Over 70,000 public employees are part of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America. delivering critical services such as healthcare and emergency response, as well as maintaining roads and sanitation systems. Even the National Postal Mail Handlers Union, representing over 47,000 U.S. postal workers, is affiliated with LIUNA. Find out what it takes for LIUNA to keep America running at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
America's Workforce is sponsored in part by Boyd Watterson Asset Management, LLC. Find out more about our investment solutions tailored to meet the needs of Taft-Hartley funds at BoydWatterson.com.
The AFL-CIO is a proud sponsor of America's Workforce Radio. United by efforts to raise wages, listeners to this show and workers all across America are beginning to turn a corner and drive the economic debate. The AFL-CIO is comprised of 12.5 million working people from 56 unions, but we stand with and fight for everyone who is working for a better life. For more information about our raising wages agenda, go to AFLCIO.org.
America's Workforce Radio is sponsored in part by the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades, District Council 6, representing painters, glazers, drywall finishers, and sign and display industry workers. They remind you that belonging to a union is your right as an American.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferentz with America's Workforce.
And remember, you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle AWF Union Podcast. Let's go to the West Coast right now. Joining us from San Francisco is Steve Rosenfeld, no stranger to the show. He's been on a number of times. He comes to us from the Independent Media Institute. It's called the Voting Booth, and he's been monitoring elections going on all around the country ever since 2020. Actually, I stand corrected. It seems ever since Bush-Gore, we've been talking about elections, election fraud, you name it. But right now, we've got voter suppression bills. Some of them are being challenged in the various legislatures. And now, Steve reports that there are more than 80, that's right, 80 election-denying candidates running for either governor, attorney general, and secretary of state. The secretary of state is really scary because these are the people that oversee voting. Steve Rosenfeld, what the heck is going on in America today?
Hi there. Well, good day. Well, what's going on is, for some people, the 2020 election has not ended, and it's not as if they just don't believe that Biden won. A lot of these people believe their political future is tied to saying that Biden didn't win, so they can win in primaries and get Donald Trump's blessing. But it's deeper than that, because basically you've got 30% of the electorate, almost entirely pro-Trump Republicans, who don't believe that elections, the last presidential election, was legitimate. And nothing has budged those numbers since November 2020. Now, that means that, you know, what a lot of people are trying to do is not working. You know, so how do you talk to these people who believe it was stolen? And nobody has a good answer.
Oh, my. Is that because Trump continues to say that the election was stolen and they're just following that? Is that a big part of it, in your opinion?
That is a big part of it. But, you know, so you might ask, why do people who were elected in 2020 on the same ballot as Republicans claim that the election was stolen from, but not their election? Their election.
Yeah.
You might. So, you know what? You got to go back to his rallies where these candidates marched on stage and Trump, like the grand MC, yanked them off stage, dangled them in front of the screaming, you know, like masses of people. And this just terrified most of these, you know, these office holders, senators like Mitch McConnell, other U.S. senators, all on down. And through the wannabes. So, you know, he retains this position of influence because he controls and brings crowds.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
These folks don't do that. So when you think about the emotional dynamics where people actually know full well that the election was not stolen, and the reason they know it wasn't stolen and there wasn't all this voter fraud is because they're trying to track voters and bring them out to vote in the same way that the Democratic Party is doing it. And they know who's voted and who doesn't. It, you know, the data is there. They don't want to talk about it. So this is going on for other reasons. You know, some of it's emotional. Some people are true believers who are disappointed. Some people are being really, I don't know what the right word is here. They know that their future depends on perpetuating this lie and this narrative. And mm-hmm. a lot of people who are not in political circles, they just keep hearing that something is wrong. They don't have a good feeling. You know, hey, Trump filled stadiums. Biden didn't. So, you know, it's kind of at that level where, and then we're also put in, we're also isolated in our little media silos. And this is really complex. It's not just media. It's the way we live demographically, you know, the way the country yeah. is, you know. So that's all going on. And then to go back to the reason you asked me to come on the show, you've got 80 candidates for statewide constitutional office, you know, governor, secretary of state, and attorney general. They all have different roles in elections. You know, the governors certify the winners. Attorney right. generals, they can sue. And then the secretaries of state, in most cases, they can oversee the mechanics, the rules, or they can set a tone. And whenever they say something, the media will cover them because, hey, it's a public official, a public record. So right. this is what's going on, and it has not changed. You know, this number, 30% don't believe of, you know, they of the electorate in 2020, they don't believe it was legit. It hasn't budged. And we're heading into primary season where the most ideological people have the most traction. So here we are.
Steve, let's do a hypothetical here. Let's predict, and hopefully it won't happen, that these election denying people that are in a power position win. Do they really have the power to say this election is a fraud, even though the facts don't add up for it? I'm just wondering. I'm looking down the road here. I'm really scared about this.
That's a really great question. And here's how this breaks down. And, you know, in the world of people who oversee and run elections, you have a split between people who tend to be the local election administrators who try to be nonpartisan. This is their civil servants. And they realize that over time, if they want to keep their jobs, they got to be able to work with Democrats and Republicans and anybody else. So they tend to be the most neutral referees. But then you have other people who basically have more political roles. And some of those are, they're on so-called canvas boards. You know, they're split sometimes from both parties. They have to, you know, they go over which ballots or signatures are accepted, rejected. You know, they can be more partisan. They can be less partisan. And then, of course, you have all the poll workers that tend to be, you know, most of them try to be neutral and just good citizens. And then you have the most partisan of the political party representatives who go in and they're challengers and say, wait, this doesn't look right. Stop everything. What's happened is nobody can keep track of the 8,000 different election jurisdictions and who are the officials and how is it happening and what's happening in the immediate aftermath of election day, because it's so decentralized. So in some places now, and this tends to be the swing states, what you've got is, in Georgia, you've got the legislature passing bills. We're not talking about voter suppression bills. We're talking about being able to purge local election officials and replace them with people who are more Republican ideologues. In Michigan, you've got people who are on those canvas boards who are being replaced by the state party. The people who are more neutral are being run out of the room, and they're being replaced by people who have greater suspicions that unless they win, something is wrong. So what's happening is you've got these, you know, in some of these battleground states, not national, it's battleground states. We're talking about Michigan, Georgia, Wisconsin, Arizona, Nevada to a little bit of a lesser extent. You've got people who are trying to purge or replace folks who have more of their hands on the wheels of the actual rules and the mechanisms and the counting. And that is sort of like a slow simmering build that's happening. So that's happening now. And it's more a setup for 2024 than 2022. But this is, you know, this is this. These are big ships. They get you turn them slowly, but this is the direction that they're headed in some of these places.
And if that comes to fruition, if that day happens in America, could we say it's the end of democracy then?
Well, this is a really, really interesting question because, you know, I just read this really cool academic article where somebody basically made a very persuasive case that we really haven't had much of a wider participatory democracy in America since, you know, until the 1960s, until the voting rights movement, the civil rights movement, because most of the access to a ballot was limited to people who were chosen as being more worthy of having a ballot, which tended to be white men. And over time, it evolved to include women. It involved, you know, until the civil rights movement of the 60s, in major parts of the country, it wasn't black and brown people to the extent that it was white people. It wasn't until the Vietnam War that we had 18-year-olds who was because they can fight, but they couldn't vote. So what's happened is we're not as old of a democracy as people actually think. And what we've got happening in these states where it's all happening, and even in Congress to some extent, it's a fight for generational power. It's a, you know, the Republican Party is aging out. They're willing to be more vicious than the Democrats. The Democrats want everyone to get along and agree to play fair. Politics doesn't operate on fairness. It operates often on, you know, who is the most vehement and willing to be the most aggressive. So this is kind of where we're at. You know, you often see progress where people take two steps or three steps forward, but then there's two steps back. And then time passes, and where are we? And then you take some steps forward again. You know, that's how I see the progress on these things. You know, you could say, although this doesn't help Democratic Party fundraising, that there's easier access to a ballot than there's ever been at any time in the country. And if you have a problem on election day, you can get the answer faster by getting a text or a tweet or a reminder than any time ever. And that is true, even in these states like Georgia and even in these states like Michigan and these swing states. But not everybody makes a plan. Not everybody, you know, is willing to think things through. You know, we don't think about voting as much as someone like I do, like every day. You know, we're different because we're in this political, you know, sphere. We have, you know, public facing voices and responsibilities to be truthful and, you know, to earn, you know, legitimacy and respect, not make up crazy stuff. So when you say, is a democracy really threatened? Well, you know, our democracy is evolving. We tend to put it on a pedestal that's probably higher than it really deserves. And yes, there has been progress at the same time. But it doesn't mean that all these negative things aren't also happening. So, and they tend to be geographically focused. Georgia, Michigan, Wisconsin, Arizona, to a lesser degree, Florida, North Carolina, Nevada. You know, these are the states, and Pennsylvania's in there too. These are the states where the fights are going to be the hardest, the tactics the ugliest. You know, and we've seen it year after year getting worse.
Yeah. Steve, it's always a pleasure having you come to the show and talk about this issue because it's an issue everybody in America should be so concerned about. Steve Rosenfeld, editor and chief correspondent for Voting Booth, which is a project of the Independent Media Institute. If you go to independentmediainstitute.org, you can get some more information. He's been on National Public Radio, Christian Science Monitor Radio, as well as a wide range of progressive publications. And, of course, this show we call America's Workforce. So stay in touch with us and keep up the fight, okay?
Well, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to talk with you and be on your show. Thank you.
Boy, talk about an eye-opening interview, huh? Steve Rosenfeld, that's one guy we definitely have to stay in touch with. All right, that's it for another edition of America's Workforce. Coming up on Monday, the Northwest Florida Federation of Labor and the explosion in digital media organizing. Until then, all of you have a safe and wonderful weekend.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.